From the Sky News Centre at 6. School children walked out of classrooms across the country earlier in protest over climate change. There was a large police presence in London's Parliament Square as youngsters climbed on statues and took over an open-top bus. But Bella Lack, who was there, says students weren't rebelling.
People did climb onto some of the traffic lights and the buses, but that was with permission, and the police said that we could then spill out onto the road, and that was only with their permission. Yeah, it was completely compliant.
The US president's confirmed he's going to declare a national emergency over the border with Mexico and insists it's legal.
We have an invasion of drugs and criminals coming into our country that we stop, but it's very hard to stop. With a wall, it would be very easy. So I think that we will be very successful in court.
It means Donald Trump can try to bypass Congress to get the money for a wall. His opposition, the Democratic Party, have called the move unconstitutional. They say they'll challenge it. A man who was filmed by his friend jumping on a tent in Hull with two homeless men in it has been jailed for 4 months. 26-year-old Jamie Nicol from Lincoln leapt feet first onto the makeshift accommodation in the city centre. Britain's spy chief has contradicted the Home Secretary and says we can't stop jihadi brides coming home. The head of MI6 says there's no way to prevent British citizens returning from Syria, even though they could pose a threat to national security. The funeral for England's 1966 World Cup winning goalkeeper Gordon Banks will be held at Stoke Minster on the 4th of March. His former club, Stoke, say the occasion will have special poignancy as it's also the anniversary of their 1972 League Cup triumph, which Banks played in. The rapper 21 Savage says he feels he shouldn't have been treated as a criminal for overstaying his American visa. The British-born star's been in the US for around 20 years, but his documents expired in 06. That's the latest. I'm Will Rowe.
Nominations
on BCFM.
BCFM. This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Green councillor for Clifton Down, Clive Stevens, and Labour councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis. Devon-based British Constitution Group and monetary reform campaigner Justin Walker, I hope, is on the line too. After the 7 o'clock news, Shamima Begum wants to come back to the UK after supporting ISIS in Syria. But who lured her out there in the first place? Nobody in the entire London media seems to be asking that question. And why have hundreds of fighters already returned to the UK without being questioned? BBC demonising Russia again. The oligarchs sponsoring anti-Putin groups in Russia going unreported on the BBC. And we take a look at Lloyds Bank's so-called business support unit here in Bristol, based in the old Bank of England Bristol offices at the edge of Castle Park. Avon and Somerset Police have come under intense criticism for not properly investigating evidence of alleged fraud at Lloyd's BSU, their bait-and-switch techniques. They've allegedly been pushing borrowers into toxic debt they can never repay. But it's not just Avon and Somerset Police who are accused of not investigating Lloyds Bank. The Police and Crime Panel, which is mostly made up of councillors in the force area, are now investigating Police Commissioner Sue Mount Stevens for not pulling the Chief Constable up over the detectives who can't find any fraud despite the alleged evidence. We hear from one Lloyds Bank victim who used to advise the Home Office on property fraud, Trevor Mealham. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. tonight, lows 7 Celsius and dry. Highs this weekend around 14. Warm, isn't it? Sunny spells tomorrow. Cooler and cloudier, though, on Sunday. Next weekend, highs around 14, 15 Celsius again. Plenty of sunny spells with a few showers, though. Next weekend, the 23rd and 24th of February, highs of 11 Celsius. Cooling down a little bit more and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, joining us in studios, Mike Davis is Labour Councillor for Ashley. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the Politics
Tony.
Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
First time, I think, on here. Can you just give us a bit of your background?
I got elected in 2016 for Ashley Ward, which is St Paul's, St Werburgh's, Montpellier and St Andrews. Before that, I worked for Thangham Debonair, the MP for Bristol West, and I still work for her part-time. I was born locally in Redfield, where I still live.
What about professional background? What sort of jobs have you done, that kind of thing?
Well, mostly politics, actually. So,
what about have you studied? You know, oh, yeah. University, that sort of thing. What did you do there?
Yeah, I went to university. I studied philosophy, and I studied abroad in America for a while. Got my master's in philosophy as well.
Have you got any favourite philosophers?
Karl Marx.
Ah, right, okay. Interesting chap. Well, anyway, so I guess that has something to do with you joining the Labour Party, did it?
Yeah.
Okay, but tell us a bit more about Marxism. What does it actually really mean? Just untangle it for us.
Well, Marx believed that history is a history of class struggle. He believed that history is shaped by our material circumstances more than it's shaped by ideas. And he believed that capitalism would eventually collapse when the working class would take over the means of production, and that would inevitably give way to socialism and then communism, which communism is a system where wealth is shared equally, where workers have democratic control over their workplace, and where it's a system where people give what they can to society, and in return they take what they need.
And this is exactly the sort of socialism that Donald Trump was saying last week. We're never going to have that here in America. what do you make of was he right, do you think, about what's going to happen here in Britain? Because some people say it looks like capitalism might collapse on its own without having to have been taken over by the workers.
I mean, it might be that it's already collapsing. It might be collapsing so slowly that we don't realise until the future what's actually happened, you know, in hindsight.
Okay, so how have you found your time on the council? What have you been up to, and what committees are you on, that sort of thing?
Oh, well, my ward's a very diverse ward. There's a lot going on in Ashley Ward, which makes it always interesting. In terms of committees, I sit on the planning committees, so we deal with all the big or controversial planning applications that come in. I sit on one of those committees with Clive, and that's been very rewarding and interesting because we have a real input into some of the really big decisions about what's happening in Bristol. So,
don't you just have to do what the planners tell you? You know, that you get these little bits of advice, don't you? The planners say, well, this is what you should do. And, I mean, you've got to be quite brave, haven't you, to say, no, actually, we don't agree. We think that's all wrong.
Every decision we make has to be a decision which accords with the local plan. So the local plan is Bristol's set of planning policies and the national plan, the national planning policy framework. So sometimes, well, every planning application, the officer, the Bristol City Council officer, not a councillor, makes a recommendation about whether we should approve or refuse it. We can disagree with that, and we can overturn the officer recommendation, and we've done that many times.
So how long is it going to be until the whole of St Paul's is covered with student flats, tower blocks?
A lot of that's already happened. It's an area of big interest to developers, and There are even more planning applications coming in. There's going to be one for the site which includes the Blue Mountain nightclub, where a developer is hoping to build quite a large development of student accommodation. So that will be an interesting application.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it? Because the thing is that if you're wanting to collect rent, one of the only places you can go where you can guarantee you're going to get that rent is to the students, because they get their guaranteed loans.
Yeah.
So this seems to be driving a lot of the development. It's just, well, students can get loans and we know they can pay the rent, so we're going to build a load of student flats. But that's surely it's only going to be, for a certain period of time, things are going to be like that. And how do you balance the needs of local people, that they don't want a big tower block next to them, and the demands of the developers then?
Well, that's the job of us on the planning committee and the planning department in the council. It's a difficult issue. I mean, the University of Bristol has expanded their student numbers, which has created a big demand for student accommodation in the city, which I'm sure Clive can also tell you about with his experiences with his ward.
Okay, cue Clive. Clive Stevens, you're a Clifton Down Green member. What do you make of the whole, your experience on these planning committees?
Well, firstly, hello, Tony. Nice to be back. Thank you. I must say I find most of the time on the planning committees it's very rewarding. You actually feel you're making a difference. And I think I can speak for most councillors, and that's why we go into this. It's not quite a job. Not quite sure how you describe it, Mike. Semi-torture. My ward, Clifton Down, which straddles White Ladies Road, has been it's very high concentration of students, a bit like Cotton, and of course it's quite close to the university, and that creates some quite difficult problems with regard to things like waste and noise and the way it changes the shopping, the retail outlook, and things like that. And a lot of the long-standing residents feel that their home has been violated almost. So something we've been doing, not only with the planning committees, but with Mike's cabinet colleague, Nicola Beach, is telling the university if it's going to expand any more, that it must not get any more housing conversions. All new students, of which many are going to be from overseas because the university is changing its strategy, are going to go into purpose-built blocks. And those purpose-built blocks are going to be in pre-agreed areas where having some students would help re-kickstart the economy. And I remember one quite recently, which was near St. Paul's, which we turned down. It was for about 350 beds, and it was just too big. It would have changed the character so much, so we turned that one down. But on the whole, any future student expansion for Bristol University is either in purpose-built blocks dotted around areas of the city which need regeneration, and we're putting in protection for residential homes so that they can't be converted to student accommodation, and that's coming through over the next year.
What kind of quality education are the students getting once they get here, do you think, Clive? Is that up to scratch, the universities, both of them, and what the education people are getting?
Well, I have to declare an interest because my daughter's currently studying at Bristol University. I used to teach at Bath University, but I had to give that up purely, actually, because class sizes were getting too big. From what I have seen, that you're putting more students into a class. Some universities are having to sack lecturers now. Not Bristol, but Cardiff is one I read about recently. I think the student learning experience is getting worse. They're paying more for it. The teachers at the university are dreadfully stretched and stressed out, and quite frankly, their career depends on their quality of research.
But the chancellors and the vice chancellors will say, well, we're not there to make profit, won't they?
But I don't think they will. Well, they would possibly will do publicly, but not in their smoke-filled meetings. They desperately need to make lots of money to pay off for all these big building expansion plans. I mean, the new university library, which I've seen plans for, it looks very good, and they're going to make the ground floor accessible to the public for public facilities. It was that 70 million, something like that, I remember, Mike? So that takes a lot of student, £9,000 to pay that off.
What about what's happening at Temple Meads? Do you know what's happening there? Because the university are developing there too, instead of the arena, aren't they?
Yeah, that's going to be... I do know what's happening there, because it's similar to what they did at Bath University when I was teaching there. They're expanding what's called their master's programmes and marketing them to overseas students, mainly Malaysia and China, and offering courses, one-year courses based on engineering and business, and combining them so that you come in, you get a master's degree from Bristol University. The fees they can charge are like double what they charge UK students, and of course if they're staying in university accommodation they get the rent and possibly the food as well. So that's their new business model, and it will be very profitable, I think, if they can pull it off.
Mike, what do you think? I thought originally that the universities were there just to teach people. Now it seems that they're also there to make a lot of money.
Well, I think part of that is to do with some of the reforms that the coalition and then the Tory government have brought in, which has meant that higher education has had to take on this more business-like approach, as has a lot of the public sector.
What would Labour do?
Well, part of Labour's plan is to make higher education free for students, for undergraduate degrees, and to give more funding to the higher education sector and the education sector more generally. Labour believes that education shouldn't be about making money for anyone. It's something that is integral to our society, and we also believe that we should have lifelong learning as well, so even after you finish university you should have options to continue learning.
Now I'm hoping we're joined on the line by Justin Walker. Justin, are you there?
I'm there. I'm here, Tony, yes.
Fantastic. Would you like to just give us a brief outline of your ideas about monetary reform? Because I know you're one of those people that says, well, when we hear we can't afford this and we can't afford that, actually, if we rearrange the way we did things, we could afford a hell of a lot more.
Well, this is it. Where to begin? Right. Well, I'd just like to ask your two friends in the studio or online at the moment. Have they ever heard of a thing called the Bank for International Settlement?
I don't believe I have, no.
Is it the same thing as the Basel Accords?
It operates from there. Essentially, it's the central bank for all the central banks, or 60 of the central banks, and it's a privately run institution, and it basically oversees 95% of the world's money supply. And barely 1% of the population know anything about it, and that included most of our elected servants in Parliament until we started telling them.
Well, I can tell you, 50% of the people in the studio, of our guests, have heard of it, so that's pretty good.
Yes, but are they aware exactly of what they're doing? Right, central banks, private banks, and the Bank of England have admitted this, they create money completely out of thin air. It's not based on anything at all. It's not gold standard. It's nothing at all. They create this money as debt completely out of thin air. Now, the central banking world is basically, how should I put it? There are about 8 or 9 banking families. I don't want to go down the path of what people say, oh, it's all anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, all this stuff. I've had all this thrown at us, and it's absolute rubbish. The point is, we are allowing, all of us on this planet, are allowing the money creation, the money supply, to be in the hands of private individuals and not our elected servants in Parliament. This is the crux of all our problems in the world. Now, if I said the Bradbury Pound to your two friends in the studio, have they, either of them, heard of the Bradbury Pound?
I have, but only because I looked it up this afternoon, so I have to...
I admire your honesty.
Including one of your articles.
Yeah. I wouldn't have found out anything about this had it not been for the fact my uncle was a director of the Bank of England from 1955 until 1972. And before that, the year before that, he attended the very first Bilderberg conference at the Hotel Bilderberg in 1954. And it was you, Tony, if I remember rightly, you told me. Because my uncle never told me he went to that August meeting. Mind you, it was a year before I was born, I hasten to add. Anyway, the point was that when my uncle died, he died back in 1983. In 2012, in September 2012, I got a phone call from somebody, a youngish fellow, who claimed that his father was very elderly, not long for this world, but wanted to give me a message because he knew who I was, and I'd actually written an article in the UK column basically saying that Abraham Lincoln created money that was based on the wealth of the federal states of America, the Union, and they basically funded the American Civil War without having to take out any loans with the private bankers. And I thought, well, why can't we have a greenback pound? Anyway, this phone call came in. And the chap told me, quite simply, my father wants to tell you the name, the Bradbury. He wants you to research it, because if you research the Bradbury, you will have a solution to all of Britain's economic woes. Now, obviously, when I came off the phone, I wondered what was all that about.
That sounds a bit like the magic money tree, Justin.
Well, it is. I mean, listen, I've actually written an article saying there is a magic money tree. The Bradbury, I mean, I started to look up Bradbury, and all I got was Julia Bradbury, the lady who runs around on, you know, going on walks and stuff, and the chap who wrote the Martian Chronicles. And eventually, I came across a chap, he was basically Jack Johnston. He was the MP, Scottish MP, who was the father of the Scottish hydroelectric scheme. And Thomas Johnston wrote a book in the 1930s called The Financiers and the Nation. And he was basically taking apart all the banking frauds and everything that's going on. And he wrote about the First World War. And he wrote about the fact that because it was all gold standard in those days, because of the uncertainty of war at the outbreak, the government was worried that people were going to, you know, go to all the banks and draw their gold out, and thus creating a complete financial collapse in the city of London, just as we were mobilizing to fight the war. And so the government, in 2 days, passed a bill through Parliament authorizing the Treasury to create money. It was £1 notes and 10 shilling notes, and in those days, £1 was equivalent of £107 today, so it's quite a lot of money. Authorising the Treasury to create debt-free and interest-free money that's based entirely on the wealth of the nation. And it's called, the technical term is M for Michael, M-naught at 100%. At the moment we do M-naught at 2.5%, which is basically the change, money you've got in your pocket. So it was an accepted fiscal practice, but not done because basically the banks have no way of involving themselves or indeed making any money out of it. And the people in Parliament at the moment, and I'm afraid all the parties are implicated here, they are very much in bed with the City of London. There's a chap sitting in the chamber, the House of Commons, called the City Remembrancer. And his job is to make sure that MPs don't ask too many questions about money creation and money supply. And it's just staggering. As I said, I didn't know anything about this. I was actually in the Green Party from 1978 to 1992. I took part in the other economic summit, TOES 1, which has since morphed itself into the New Economics Foundation. And I'd read the Brandt Report. I knew about the appalling inequality between the North and the South. And that's what motivated me. I wanted to see, basic income scheme. I wanted to see more money created and pushed into the system.
Yeah, just a second, though, because, I mean, surely if you started printing as much money as you wanted, I mean, what all the economists will tell you, Justin, you create inflation.
Ah, yes, that's what all the economists will tell you, and I'm afraid it's bunkum. Right, let's go back to the Weimar Republic. Now, the Weimar Republic, everyone cites that as a perfect example. He also mentions Zimbabwe and stuff, but they always go back to the Weimar Republic. You can't just print money, otherwise you get hyperinflation. Well, let's get one thing straight. The Weimar Republic, the government did not create the inflation. It was the private Bundesbank, the central bank, privately controlled, and it was Wall Street and the City of London.
But you don't need to go back to the Weimar Republic, because they're doing quantitative easing now in the European Union for the euro, yeah. The pound, the Bank of England are doing it, and they're doing it for the dollar as well. But anyway, yeah. Thanks. I think we just have to draw a line under that. And if you could just give us one... place to go, or one article of yours to look up, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page about monetary reform, because I think we need to get on and talk about some of the effects of what that might do, you know.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's fine. We'll go to the New Chartist Movement, all one word, newchartistmovement.org.uk, and you will find links pages, and there's a whole range of articles and organizations and people involved and stuff. In fact, we're just redoing the website, so please be patient, because the website's having a complete spring cleaning.
I'll find something anyway. I'll put a link up on to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But before we get off planning, you know, we were talking there about we need the money to do things. You were, Mike, anyway. Clive, can you tell us a bit about what's been going on most recently up at Stoke Lodge? Because I know you've been getting involved with that, even though you're not necessarily on the same planning committee.
I've been getting involved with Stoke Lodge because of the impact it's going to have on the trees. So haven't been involved with the fence itself, because that's an issue between the local councillors.
Well, let's just sketch what's happening, because it's a piece of land owned by the council which is used by Cottam School, and as a result, Cottam School said we need to fence it off, although there's some dispute about whether they really do or not. Can you tell us what's the latest on this?
Well, they have a long lease. Cottam School have a long lease from the council, which gives them maintenance rights and other rights. And because it's not it's not a public right of way, or you know, town green, that type of thing, they can put a fence up to a certain height without planning permission. This is what I'm told by the officers. And I've left that as that. That's if there are issues, that's down to the Stoke Lodge people of Stoke Bishop, the councillors and the council. But what we then discovered, because the trees there, some of them are the most beautiful trees and protected trees in Bristol, the fence was taking a direction right through the root zones of those trees. And of course, if you start chopping roots off trees, you can eventually kill them. So that's where I got involved, because I wanted to make sure that proper planning applications were put through for tree preservation orders. And I made a statement at one of the planning meetings 2 or 3 weeks, maybe it was 4 weeks ago now, to that very effect. One of the other councillors there, Councillor Eddy, who normally I don't see eye to eye at all on, but occasionally you agree on things, pick that up. He's actually the vice chair of that committee. But that idea was then dismissed, and then they moved on to all the other things. But since then, the We Love Stoke Lodge group have served, it's the beginnings of a judicial review. There's a protocol, a commencement protocol for that. So the legal officers at the council have now asked us to be careful what we say, and certainly not to talk direct to any of the parties. So there's not a lot that Mike and I can say, but from what I've told you, and my motivation, you might remember 10 years ago I chaired the Bristol Tree Forum, and that's going from strength to strength, and I'm one of the councillors who happens to love Bristol's trees, and we should protect them. And if a fence is going to chop the roots off, that fence, that needs to go for planning permission in order to make sure the fence goes in the right place.
Well, what's happened is that the We Love Stoke Lodge group has written to the council threatening legal action over the erection of the fence.
It's more than that. They've actually taken the first step of legal action.
Okay. And they're saying effectively that they believe the decision of council officers was unlawful. But that's where we are with that. I imagine you'd say, again, Mike, you don't want to talk about that either, do you? Well, what can you say?
You know, one of the issues involved is the issue of permitted development. So it's a concept in planning where various changes to sites or buildings can happen without needing to go through a full planning process. It's more of a sort of take-back exercise. So it started with loft extensions, so that you could put a loft extension on your house without needing to go through a very complicated planning process. But now permitted development is allowed for various things. One of them is fences. Another one, which is causing a lot of issues in my ward, is office to residential conversion. So you could convert a massive office block into flats and it can't go through a proper planning process. But I mean, that's another issue. You know, I think Stoke Lodge, obviously I can't say too much because we've been advised that because of this possible judicial review, we can't, you know, just bias what might happen because of councillors saying things about it. But I think, you know, it shows that green spaces can be very important to the communities they're located in, but also that the city's population is growing and schools are expanding, and those school children need places to play sport on.
Well, I'm sure that the locals would say, but they don't need a fence. And in fact, that I understand that the school's regulator has also said they don't need a fence. So anyway, we shall see what happens with this, because yes, especially with this potential judicial review on the horizon, it'll be fascinating to see. Also, I thought I'd just ask, and I'll ask Justin first, I think, about this, is we've had this intervention this week by John McDonnell answering a question, talking about Winston Churchill. Was he a hero or was he a villain? What do you make of that, Justin?
Well, can I just very quickly come in, just go back to trees.
Sure, okay.
Quickly, and just say that we are alarmed by what's happened in Sheffield, and where there's been hundreds of trees felled, and we are being led to believe it's because of the rollout of 5G, and 5G doesn't like wet leaves. And 5G, in fact, is extremely harmful. Could I just sort of give a warning to our friends in the studio that 5G is dangerous, and 5G could well lead to a mass of felling of trees. So I think we just need to be aware of that.
Well, I think as I understand it, Bristol is a 5G test bed, or one of the first places 5G is rolling out. So rather than say what I was asking, let me just ask Clive and Mike here in the studio what they make of this rollout of 5G here in Bristol.
I mean, I've heard from many sources that there are concerns about 5G, but it's not an area that I know too much about.
Can I just say also, 4G seems to work pretty well. I can upload a YouTube video which is like an hour long in about 2 minutes on 4G. I don't really need 5G personally. Anyway, Clive, what do you make of 5G?
A bit like Mike, both of us wrote down 5G, so because we've listened to what Justin said, and we better ask appropriate questions next week at that planning meeting. I know you like, apparently, Tony, you like conspiracy theories. I think it's being encouraged by the government in order to have yet another auction, in order to financially bail them out. It's a way of taxing Vodafone and O2 and companies like that. So we shall see. I'm very happy with my 4G, and I'm not quite sure what 5G would bring. But if it does bring huge benefits, then as long as it doesn't create any downsides. Now, Tony, I have a question for Justin. I read one of his articles, short one. Do we have time for me to ask him? Okay. Justin, you still there?
Yes, I'd be delighted, yeah.
OK, I read your, I think it was by you, Bradbury to the Rescue. I'm not sure how old that article is.
About 3 years old.
OK. In there, where you're talking about the Bradbury Pound, and I'm asking this purely because I am interested, it talks about by issuing this, we would have a currency that would be impervious to the international banking system, because I think you're saying that it's being issued by the Treasury. So I wrote those words down from the article. If it's impervious to the international banking system, does it mean it wouldn't be convertible to dollars or to euros or that? Or would it be convertible?
Okay, well, I think the first thing, it's a big and huge subject, this. But the first thing we've all got to realise is that the criminals are running the show. The Bank for International Settlements is a criminal entity. All the central banking, everything, it's all about creating money out of thin air and causing debt onto humanity as a whole.
Okay, I'm going to have to just stop you there because one of the people we've interviewed on here, Rowan Bosworth Davis, is a former Fraud Squad officer. He was saying effectively the same as you're saying, Justin, which was that the City of London, and this is the evidence he submitted to the Treasury Select Committee, was an organised criminal enterprise. He said, under all the definitions of an organised criminal enterprise, what the City of London is up to fulfils all the criteria. So I will just back you up in saying that. But can I ask you to be really, really quick in answering Clive, because we've got a lot of other things to talk about.
I'll be very, very quick. But the most important thing is if every nation in the world embraces what we call sovereign national credit and the government creates the money that is needed for the NHS, social welfare, defence, education. I mean, we were talking about education a moment ago. Students shouldn't have to pay anything at all. They should not leave university with a debt mount, debt all around their neck. No, that is ridiculous. And again, the wealth of a nation, and our nation is valued at something like £30 trillion, that's the Office of National Statistics. £10 trillion of that is the actual wealth of a nation. £20 trillion is approximately, well, the labour potential, your creativity. Now, we wouldn't create anything like that, otherwise you would get hyperinflation. But you could certainly put, John McDonnell was wanting to put £500 billion, half a trillion into the economy to sort out all the problems. And that is certainly feasible with the Bradbury, the Treasury, creating that money and putting it in a very careful way. And, of course, the other thing is you don't need direct taxation. If you do that, you don't need any direct taxation, and you would only keep, VAT and things like that if you did need to relieve any inflationary pressures.
Okay, now you can tell me what you think of Winston Churchill, please. A villain or hero?
Right, well, I've studied the man in great detail. I'm going to say that for the World War II, he's a hero, without a shadow of a doubt. 1940, you talk to anyone who was alive then, who listened to his voice, he was a hero. But my source of information is Field Marshal Allenbrook, the diaries of Field Marshal Allenbrook, because there you see the good side to Winston Churchill and you see the downside. He had a thing called Black Dog. He had depression. He was prone to suddenly shooting off at a tangent, having agreed on a strategy with his generals and admirals. Suddenly you shoot off at a tangent.
That's like exactly like we just did.
Yeah, exactly. But sometimes it's brilliant what he thought. I mean, he was the creator of the tank in the First World War. I mean, the guy was an incredible individual, but he had enormous frailties. And when they're talking about what happened in the Welsh miners and stuff, that certainly doesn't reflect well on him. I think the very fact the Labour Party could work with him during the war, I mean, he was a team player. He was insisting that the Labour Party, everyone played their part in the national government to defeat Hitler.
Okay, so, Justin, hang on. We're going to ask Clive the same question now. Clive Stevens, you're a Green councillor for Clifton Down. What was Churchill, a hero or a villain?
Churchill was a very great man. And I think he learnt from his mistakes early on. He made some big mistakes, made some big decisions, and he learnt. And I think from what I can hear and read through the Second World War, he did a fantastic job for us, and not only for us, but for Europe and maybe the world.
Mike, you're a Labour councillor for Ashley.
Well, you know, I don't think... I reject the whole premise of the question, really. I don't think everything has to be so black and white. Someone's either a villain or a hero.
What do you think you did right or wrong? How about that for a question?
I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know his biography in detail. I mean, I know he did great things for this country in the Second World War, but I know that, you know, previous to that, you know, he probably did some quite bad things, and John McDonnell was trying to start a conversation about some of those things, like the Tony Pandy incident. So I think it's important that we appraise our history honestly, and, you know, things aren't black and white.
Yeah, let's not eulogise Winston Churchill, because he got things wrong as well as he got things right. I would also say, I mean, if you had to ask me one or the other, you know, I do like answering questions, if people ask me questions one way or the other. I would say villain, actually, because if you look at his arrangements that he made at the end of the war with his personal assistant, Major Desmond Morton, and the relationship that Morton had with Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's secretary, John Ainsworth Davis, under the pen name of Christopher Crichton, wrote a fascinating book in the 1990s where he said that Churchill was in on this whole looting of Germany at the end of the war, and that he knew, and Morton knew, exactly where all the gold, the Nazi gold, went at the end of the war, and it went to the international mafia, and they made sure it went to the international mafia. So there is a big question about, I mean, this is that thing people always ask, don't they, what happened to the Nazi gold? What happened to all that money they looted from all the central banks of the whole of Europe in 1945? It all disappeared. Where did it go? Well, John Ainsworth Davis says, and he was a commando who was sent on a mission to rescue Bormann, and the reason they had to have Bormann was because he had the signatures to the bank accounts in Switzerland where all that money was. And Churchill, if he wanted to, could have called it out, and he said no, that money should go back to where it came from, but no, he didn't, and the money went to the international mafia over in South America. Was laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm in New York, which was controlled by the Dulles brothers. So anyway, that's the reason why I asked you this, really, because I think there's quite a lot to more to Churchill than meets the eye, and that, well, I think will come out in history. Justin,
Can I just say that I'm always suspicious about Brendan Bracken and stuff, because Brendan Bracken always managed to get Zionist money and various other things given to Churchill to help him out from his debts. There, some people say that he was a Freemason.
Well, he definitely was. He definitely was.
Oh, he definitely was. But what level? At what level? I think he was more a useful idiot, and I don't like saying that because I do admire what he did in 1940. But I would say that he was used, but he was also an aristocrat. He was also, you know, the product of his age.
He wanted to nuke Moscow in the 1950s. They had to keep him off the BBC because every time he went onto live television, he kept saying, "We've got to nuke Moscow." So people forget about things like that. Anyway, look, let's move on because let's talk about Brexit. We've only got a quarter of an hour left. We've got to get there somehow. I'd like maybe we'll go to you first, Justin. Say, can you explain Brexit to us and what's going to happen on the 29th of March, if anything?
I'm just going to say this, that the European Union was the creation, ultimately, of the bankers, and it started off in Nazi Germany, which I know you will know a lot more than I do, Tony. But certainly the meeting at the Red Hotel, or the Hotel Rouge in Strasbourg, and I think it was September 44, something like that.
August 1944, yeah.
Yeah, well, certainly the roots of this European project certainly seemed to start there. And the Bank for International Settlements played its part.
So what's going to happen? Look, this is what I'm asking you. What's going to happen on the 29th of March,
well,
Justin?
I personally think what they're hoping for is chaos. They're hoping, we know there's a financial reset due at some point. There's going to be a collapse even worse than 2008. We know that the German economy is hovering into recession, Italy, Spain, all doing it. What I would like to see is go back to the European, well, go back to the common market, go back to free trade, sovereign nations working in harmony together on strategic issues like transport, the environment, and free trade, working in harmony, but keeping their differences, their differences in culture.
Now let's ask Mike Davis. Mike, what do you think is going to happen on the 29th of March?
I think the government has planned this very badly. I think after the 2017 election result, they should have gotten their act together much quicker than they did. I think they had some terrible people in the cabinet dealing with this, David Davis, Boris Johnson, etc. There's so much legislation to untangle, not just primary legislation, but secondary legislation, statutory instruments, all these little, very boring things that they have to do in small committees. There's about 800 of those they need to get through. It's not going to happen. So I think they'll delay.
How long for?
3 months or so, perhaps. Theresa May's not going to look very good because she's been saying over and over again, we'll definitely leave on the 29th of March. But
she seems to have stopped saying that quite so much, doesn't she, over the last few years. Anyway, Clive, what do you make? What's going to happen, if anything?
Well, at the council, we're beginning to make contingency plans for no deal. And a lot of them are issues after Brexit, things like losing staff, that type of thing. But one of the issues is things like food shortages and the impact on the homeless or the poor.
So is Marvin stockpiling rice for us?
I don't know whether he is yet. I don't think he'd admit it. But there is a situation. One of the concerns is that you imagine that we all start stockpiling foods middle end of March.
Though, I mean, is it realistic to say that we're not going to be able to get food into the country? I mean, you're making it sound like there's going to be a blockade of Britain, like with gunboats circling, you know, German gunboats and French gunboats circling Britain so that food can't get in. I mean, surely, you know, there may be a bit of an increase in price, but food is still going to come into the country, surely.
Food will come in, but start thinking about our dear friends, the French lorry drivers and the other ports and on the continent. You have to start thinking, if they want to negotiate even with their own government, what better time to do it than the 30th of March and start having traffic hold-ups?
So will there be a no-deal Brexit? What do you think?
I don't think there will be, actually, but it's well worth planning for one, just in case. I think that, obviously, Theresa May, Mike mentioned, the 2017 election, Theresa May wanted a bigger majority so she didn't have to listen to the Brexiteers. That went badly wrong, so she stuck with the impact of that. And I think that somehow or other, she and Parliament, because remember, it's Parliament is supreme, not the Prime Minister, in the fundamental constitution, will decide to go for a 3-month extension and get things thrashed out.
So we joined the common market back in 1972 and without any kind of vote or anything, but then in 1975 there was actually a referendum. One of the things I'm trying to do over the weeks before the 29th of March, Brexit or no Brexit, is to do little flashbacks to there, because there was a particularly good debate in 1975 just before the referendum in June 75 to join the common market, where we said yes, we will stay in the common market. It was basically won by the Remainers, effectively. And so let's have a listen now to the Labour's spokesperson on the common market, who at the time was Michael Foot, and the former Conservative Prime Minister Edward Heath, debating whether or not we should join what at the time was the EEC or the common market.
I'm now going to deal with the legislative powers, because they can only act insofar as we as a Parliament agree. And Parliament agreed to the transfer of this element of sovereignty when we signed the treaty and when we passed the legislation which took us into the community. Now it is the responsibility of the British Foreign Secretary to see that that is adhered to. What is more, within that scope, they cannot take any action on any single subject unless the British Foreign Secretary agrees. Let's take a practical example, the juggernauts. Mm-hmm. Now the Commission put forward a proposal that there should be the standardisation of lorries for transport in Europe. Mm-hmm. At first sight, a sensible proposition. Mm-hmm. It helps the manufacturer of lorries, for one thing, would help us in supplying the community market instead of just our own. But exception was taken to it in this country. It was raised in Parliament, and the result was that the legislation hasn't come forward. Now, this is a practical example of how the community works. And similarly, when the Commission is going to put forward proposals, you know perfectly well, it discusses them with each government individually first. And if it puts forward a proposal under our new arrangements, it's discussed in Parliament. And Parliament can express its view and vote upon it.
Yes,
and does so. All of those things are democratic processes. And they do it in order that the Foreign Secretary shall know how he uses the power delegated to him when he goes to Brussels.
It is not, in my opinion, a democratic procedure that laws should be made by executive ministers.
It's Michael Footner.
Contrary to the whole spirit, democratic spirit of the British Constitution. But what Mr. Heath is defending now is that laws should be made by executive ministers in the Council of Ministers, and that is where it happens. Now he says, they've got to come back to the British Parliament and get sanction for what they're doing. Not in every case by any means at all. Sometimes Parliament may be able, after great difficulty, to put a spoke in the wheels. The juggernaut one was one example, although there is no certainty that that is going to be valid forever by any means. And as Mr. Heath knows very well indeed, what happens in the Council of Ministers is not that you can use the veto at every turn to try and ensure, or that you can return to your own Parliament to try and give them a chance to put a spoke in the wheel, or that they even have the time to do it. What happens is that you have a series of bargains made, for example, covering food prices and food generally, and those bargains, you have to make a compromise in one case to get a favour in another case. The difference is, what has happened is that whereas the arrangements about the food prices and food settlements used to be made in Westminster by a cabinet responsible to a democratic parliament, now they are made in these bargains in Brussels, and where the decision about the price of food is made not in a democratic procedure or a democratic legislature or by a cabinet responsible to a democratic legislature, but by a system of compromise, coalition arrangements, whatever you like to call them, a quite different method of procedure. Now, I think the pro-marketeers, I think they've got a case, but I think they'd make their case much better if they had the temerity to admit the fact that, of course, these institutions are not the same as our democratic ones. They're very different indeed and work by very different methods. There may be a case for doing it, but there is no case at all for concealing or attempting to conceal from the British public how much of their democratic power is reduced.
So
that was Michael Foot finishing there. We heard Edward Heath for the Conservatives beforehand. That was from 1975 from Thames Television.
You could play that now. Well, you have played it now, but it's still relevant now. And part of one of the problems I had with the EU, I'm actually a Remainer, but open. Realising that the lack of democracy in the EU, even now they have a European Parliament, is lacking because you can't overturn a judgment of European Court of Justice. And the European Parliament needs to have more power so they can do that. And that's my fundamental problem with the EU.
You think it'd be a good idea to try and stick it out and reform the EU?
Yeah, I do, because I think lots of other countries feel the same way, and I think the benefits of sticking it out, you need big groupings nowadays. The problems we have are you've got global business, you've got global climate change. You need big groups that can negotiate together. Becoming our own little offshoot off of a continent is just the wrong direction.
Oh, you're swamped by the Americans. Anyway, Mike, what do you make of that we just heard, the discussion between Edward Heath and Michael Foot there?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Clive said. I mean, obviously that was a long time ago, but obviously some of the issues still are relevant. I think, obviously, it would have been better to stay in the EU and try to reform it. I think
David Cameron was doing that, wasn't he? Now Theresa May's trying to do it, and she's getting nowhere. mean, it just keeps going backwards and forwards. There's quite a lot of air miles being built up between Brussels and London.
Well, that's to negotiate leaving the EU. I think we should have stayed in the EU and been a voice for more democracy in the EU. But, you know, I think, actually, no matter how bad it was, and I don't think it was that bad, I mean, only about 15% of our laws directly came from the EU.
Okay,
and a lot of those laws are actually good things for workers' rights, environmental protections, consumer protections, and so on.
Justin, what do you make of that clip?
I'm just going to remind you again that the European Union was set up by criminals to serve criminals. It was set up by the people who control our money unlawfully for the people who control our money unlawfully. We are up against a deep state. We're up against the 1%. We've got to work out exactly what they're doing and how they're doing things to us. Now, the European Union is not a force for good. Some sort of European confederation or getting back to a common market would be perfect sense.
Okay, just let's have a listen now, though, to a guy called Guy Verhofstadt, because he has been saying, I mean, we had last week, didn't we? We had, who was it who was saying that the British would be a special place in hell for us? I thought it was Donald Tusk. And this week we've had more of these rather nasty statements being made. This week it was that the Brexit people will be guillotined after everyone realises what disaster they've caused. So that was by Guy Verhofstadt. So let's have a little listen to him now.
With the Tory party, the hard Brexiteers are compared to the leaders of the French Revolution. I think Gove is Brissot and Boris Johnson is Danton and Rees-Mogg is compared to Robespierre. But we should not forget that the efforts of these men were not appreciated by the common man they claim to represent, because they all ended on the guillotine. So that's important to remind.
Is that, I mean, Mike, do you think that's a fair comment to make on it? I mean, some people have said that that's really not, you know, that's below the belt.
I mean, firstly, I think these figures in the EU, although obviously Brexit must be very frustrating for them and difficult to understand, I think they should be sensitive about the kind of things they're saying. I also think, though, that, you know, I've been watching some documentaries about the French Revolution recently, and, the people involved in the French Revolution, they were real philosophers, they were visionaries, and the people currently leading the Tory party are not that at all.
Clive, what do you think of the comments?
I know more about the Donald Tusk one, and he was saying that, of course, in Ireland, and a way of support, basically showing solidarity with the Irish Prime Minister. He knew when he was saying it was going to be controversial. Do you remember little grin when he walked off the stage?
Well, we've also had Leo Varadkar saying, I think it's this morning, saying something, you're going to get a nasty surprise as well. Almost, I mean, I suppose that's what's normal. As you get close to the edge of this 29th of March, everything sort of heats up a bit, doesn't it?
Mm.
Some of the Brexiteers have been saying ridiculous things, you know, people saying that Ireland should leave as well so that we don't have to deal with the Irish border issue, which is
But they haven't been given a vote, have they? They probably would vote to stay in, wouldn't they? Almost certainly. There's a lot of countries out there that would like a vote, but they haven't been given one. Justin, what do you make of those comments?
I think we ought to be aware of the fact that Ted Heath, had he been alive today, would be in court on a charge of paedophilia and possibly child murder.
Well, that's easy to say that, because he's dead now, right? Yes, and you can't libel someone who's dead. But all I would say is that the chief constable over in Wiltshire didn't actually say that. What he said was that he believed that he was doing child molestation, not paedophilia. I mean, there's quite a subtle difference. Anyway, thanks very much to our guests. That is to say, Mike Davis, Labour councillor, and Clive Stevens. We'll be back after the news to look at some international stories.
93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.